Welcome back, everyone, to episode 3 of the TPL Pod. Today we are joined by Lance Wheeler, creator of the Core Velocity Belt. You're not going to meet many pitching coaches more knowledgeable than Lance, especially when it comes to developing efficient lower half mechanics. Lance is now a highly sought-after pitching consultant, and the Core Velocity Belt has become a staple in major league clubhouses. He takes us through his journey from volunteer assistant at Lipscomb University through the development of the belt until now, when he's retooling guys like Lance McCullers and Lucas Giolito. Lance does a great job of taking the complex and making it simple through his use of analogies that we can all understand. Now, without further ado, let's get into it. Hey Lance, thanks so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate you joining me.
Good to be here, man.
So I wanted to talk to you today. For those who are unaware, I don't think anybody is, Lance Wheeler is the founder of the Core Velocity Belt, which is a tool that's kind of revolutionized how professional pitchers are training their lower halves. There's always been a lot of discussion about getting into your legs, utilizing your lower half more efficiently. But at least in my experience, nobody really ever taught me what that meant. There was always the discussion, but there was never, how are we going to go about doing this? And I learned about you through a buddy of mine, and I'd been following your social accounts and seeing kind of what you've been doing. And for a premise that's very simple, it's pretty revolutionary what you've been able to do. So I'm curious today to hear you talk about kind of how you've developed your belt, what went into that, and kind of where you've, the progression that's taken you now from, you know, college pitching coach to a guy who's heavily sought after by major leaguers looking to reinvent their mechanics. So it's very cool, and I appreciate you taking the time today.
Yeah, well, first off, like, it's not like I'm some genius that came up with this. I was a volunteer at Lipscomb University. This was, goodness, 2005. And so I would go, and I'd pick up my daughter and would come back to do pitching lessons on a hardwood basketball floor. So it was Riley, my oldest daughter. And so one day, you know, I've had a couple of lessons in the gym, and there was a J-band laying around. She was the kind of kid that got into everything. So she puts the J-band around her waist, takes off her shoes, and she's on her socks. So she would just back up, and then she would just drop to her butt and just, like, she was water skiing across the hardwood floor. So
okay.
It just slide. And so I'm like, wow, it's a perfect babysitter. So about 15 minutes into it, I guess it's that parental instinct, I happened to turn around, and there she was. I can see it almost in slow motion. Her heels catch, and when it did, it throws her forward. So it just projects her just right into this.
Just flying straight through.
Like a concrete wall. And I'm thinking, holy crap, my daughter's dead. But halfway down there, the pitching coach jumps out. I'm like, man, this would be perfect for pitchers. So we canceled the lesson. We went off to Walmart and got a back support brace, brought it home to my wife, Mandy. And it took us about 10 years and 2 sewing machines to get it right. She was like Cinderella or Snow White, whichever one of the characters were sewing. Blowing up sewing machines, cursing, saying every curse word known to man, trying to get this right. But yeah, it took us about 10 years to finally get it right. And it wasn't until 2012 that we actually realized what we had, because initially I thought it was an overspeed device. Hey, let's just hook this on. It's going to pull you forward. It's going to pull you faster. It's going to increase your velocity. But that wasn't the case at all. At the time in 2012, everybody was talking about the inverted W. They were talking about high elbows. And so we had a fifth rounder in. We were training with these guys, and we put him on the belt and noticed right away that the arm action cleaned itself up. So I'm like, wow, this is – maybe we've got something here. And so I really started to look at the pitching a little bit differently, because, you know, we play a rotational sport that's really dominated by linear cues, and we wonder why so many guys struggle to rotate their hips. And then you think about today's culture with kids. They're not out climbing trees. They're not riding bikes. They're sitting in front of a Zoom or a video game, and so they're constantly sitting. So they don't move as well as what you're going to find in other cultures. So really, after looking at it, just really changed how I look at the entire delivery, and how everything really starts proximal, meaning the middle of the body, and then works to the distal segments, the feet and the hands.
So you realized early on there that once you transitioned from this idea of I'm trying to propel somebody down a hill to changing the focus to maintaining your stability and your balance over the hill longer, that was when arm actions cleaned up. That was when all these other positive effects took place.
Yeah. Once you can start to control the middle of the body, the more efficient I am in the middle, the more efficient the distal segments are going to become, because really at the end of the day, the arm's at the mercy of the hips. because as the hips initiate the turn, the shoulders, you know, the pelvis serves as the stability point, the foundation for the shoulders to rotate upon. So if I've got an unstable or an inefficient table to rotate upon, then it's just not going to happen.
Right. So with this belt idea, so it started, you know, you needed a belt because you wanted to center guys in their hips.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the drills you've taught, I think what amazes me about your whole thing is the simplicity of it. Is your focus is always on providing external cues to get somebody to do something internally, and then your motto of trust what you feel.
Yeah.
Don't try to make this more complicated than it has to be. And so I think what makes it, what's really interesting to me is that the focus is always on trying to tell somebody what to do, but your focus tends to be on what you need to feel.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point, because let's be honest, like when we hear all this technical talk and you hear a lot of people, it's like they're reading straight out of an anatomical textbook.
Right.
And that sounds cool, but it seems like nowadays the more complicated that you make it, it creates the need for the expert. Wow, I didn't understand a word he said, so he must be really good. I need that guy. But the problem with that is that the kinetic change starts with the brain, and most of what I see is players are just confused. Their perception of the movement is off. That's why I really think that a lot of the mechanical flaws we see are man-made. It's just the body would never organize itself that way unless it was confused. And that's one of the first things that we start at with whenever we're working with the players, getting their history of cues, knowing their perception of the movement, what they would teach, how they look at it, how they believe, what they believe. Because you think what they believe is the correct way to do it is what they practice, because what they practice is how they move. So really it comes down to their beliefs and their perception. So we always look at it as the kinetic change starts with the brain. And then the second part of that is we're just trying to enhance the mind-muscle connection between the middle of the body and the brain. I think a lot of times when we start to give guys cues, it's kind of like your computer. If I've got multiple tabs open, the downloading is going to be much slower. The processing is going to be much slower. So we try to keep it to one tab.
That makes a lot of sense. Very cool. Your progression now, you've become a pretty sought after consultant. I know I was connected with you through Adam Plutko, who's a pitcher with the Indians. Do you discuss when you work with a guy who's a well-known major leaguer? I know you've shared that you've worked with Lance McCullers in the past. Is the way you teach these premises, are they any different than you would for a younger kid, or is it something that anybody can grasp?
No, it's the same. Like we've had 10-year-olds in the same room with guys that you just mentioned, because really it comes down to them taking ownership, and again, it's their perception. I think the job as a coach is the best ones I've seen are the best communicators. It's being able to ask questions, put it in their own words, because at the end of the day, if they don't understand it, it really doesn't matter. So we keep it really simple. When we talk about feel, we're just using it as a four-step acronym, really. First one is your focus. What are you trying to do? Because a lot of what you see, form follows function, but function follows purpose. So what is your purpose of what you're trying to do? Let's make that really clear, because if I don't have a clear goal, it's kind of hard to know if I made the shot, if I never knew what I was shooting at. So what's the goal of the activity? The E is just explore. We don't ever know how it's going to work for anybody. So the thing is, we're going to try different things. And then the second E is just eliminate. We're going to start to eliminate what doesn't work, because really it's just trial and error. We don't ever know. We just want to know that if we're throwing crap to the wall and it sticks, we want to know what it was that we actually threw up there so we can go back to it. Because one of the worst things you'll see, and I'll use an easy example, if you're working on a certain pitch, it's the nastiest slider you've ever thrown. Zach, how'd you do that? I don't know. So yeah. Now you're spending 2 weeks trying to refine that versus 2 weeks refining that process. And then finally, the L is just a learned association, because really that's what feel is. Everybody talks about data, but we use data every day when we're driving down the road and we're looking at the speedometer, and we can feel the difference between 85 versus 15 in the school zone. So it's really about just taking the data. To me, is not really the teacher, it's the teacher's aid. So we're just really taking the data, the numbers we're shooting for, and we're just trying to create a learned association for it.
It makes a lot of sense, because I think the hardest part of reinventing mechanics and of adjusting drills is that you have, to your point, you have an idea of what you think it should look like, but you don't always know how to like get there from a feel perspective, because you have been prescribed drills. So I know you've talked about in the past how you posted videos of yourself where you're like, oh man, I can't believe that was a premise I was teaching then. What do you think that your premise was wrong, or do you just think that there was a simpler way to get to what you wanted to get to?
That's a good question. I think it's both. I think one was a lack of understanding of how the body really worked. I think so many times that we focus on the legs, but then we'll drop a quote that, hey, the kinetic chain works proximal to distal. So we're kind of going against what we just said there. But as far as
what is for a 12-year-old who's not sure what those terms mean.
Yeah, you just talked about being simple. Here I am dropping proximal. Yeah. Proximal is just the middle of the body. So as I work from the middle of the body out, the distal segments would just be the hands and the feet. So the body works from the middle of the body out. So the better I can control the middle of my body in a rotational sport, the faster, the more efficient the swing is going to be, the faster, more efficient the throw is going to start to become.
Which is why this is a core velocity belt and not core velocity shoe adjustments, even though it starts with how grounded we are, our whole foot being plugged into the rubber. The focus needs to be from the center of the body.
Yeah, and and speaking of the center of the body, and this is something that really changed it all for me, was a lot of it was just riding skateboards. It was stuff outside the realm of baseball. And I was walking down the beach one day, and I see this guy floating around in a hammock, and I'm like, holy crap, we play a rotational sport. So if we're going to be able to rotate, think about like with the hammock. Both sides of the hammock have to be anchored, or you're not going to be able to sway through the middle. So unless I'm anchoring my eyes and my feet, I'll never move efficiently through the middle of my body. And I think sometimes people forget that. We get so caught up on looking at slow motion video or, you know, frame by frame.
I'm a bad culprit of this.
Yeah, that we never actually think that there's so many other parts going on. For example, yesterday my little girl walks in. She goes, Dad, I hit another car. She was on the bike.
That's better than a car.
Yeah. But what she was doing is as she's riding, she wants to make sure you're watching her. So wherever her eyes start to go, the bike starts to go. And that's the same thing that I see with a lot of pitchers. So when eyes start to move a certain way, then the feet start to shift. And so suddenly I can't rotate because I get to the front part of my foot and I have to push out. So, but going back to your original question as far as just the evolution of it all, I think it was just more of trying and not being afraid to fail and trying to pride myself in being humble enough to realize I didn't have all the answers, because you know how it goes, Zach. The more you start to dig deeper into this, the more you learn, the less you know. So it's just been constantly evolving.
You also get the affirmation of like, I think I did something right. I did it right and it went well. And now that must be my baseline. But you may have like gotten there not necessarily doing what you set out to do, you know? So I feel like for myself, when I've been trying to learn a lot about these lower half mechanics, I thought that it had to be like my hips needed to be tilted a certain way. And so you just end up with these like certain premises stuck in your brain, and you think you're like, oh, wow, I'm progressing pretty well, but you're not experiencing what you actually set out to experience.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, so that's always the biggest challenge of it. So for yourself personally, what has this core velocity belt journey brought you as far as satisfaction from being a college pitching coach to now you're, you know, being asked to speak at a lot of different functions, you're sought after by major leaguers. Is this something that you intended? Did you think this was the way this was going to go?
No, in no shape, form, or fashion. We actually started Baseball Think Tank, the original site, after I got done with college baseball. And none of this was intended to be a business. It really wasn't. I was just I was out of college baseball. I was working with Hunter Bledsoe, a sports agency. And so I said, as I'm doing these lessons, I'm going to start to videotape some of this. And I'm going to write a couple of emails. So I was just talking to my buddies in college baseball. And I'm like, holy crap, people are actually reading some of this stuff. And then from there with the belt, like, again, it was just something I was using for my players at Lipscomb and the University of Louisiana Monroe. And it was never intended to be this way. And it just kind of took off on its own. So that's a cool part of it. It's just, you know, just being able to share that. But I think the coolest part of anything is having a thought or something in your mind and actually seeing it take physical form is pretty cool, and especially be able to share that with Mandy and you know, some of the opportunities that it's brought us. So it's been pretty cool.
Very cool. Yeah. So with how you've been able to teach the belt versus teaching a standard pitching lesson, I know you've always discussed this as like a tool, but you're still teaching pitching premises. Are there certain things that you've seen guys have just way better success with when they've taken the belt and used it a certain way? Or is your whole premise more guided towards personal exploration so that you can feel what you need to feel?
That's a great question. Really, when you think about pitching mechanics, it's just a series of sub-movements. And the efficiency of one movement is based on how efficient the previous movement was. So if we looked at dominoes and we set out a row of dominoes, we said, hey, these are pitching mechanics. So you knock over the first domino, but the last three or four don't fall. Say that's hip-shoulder separation, that's front leg bracing, that's position of the arm. If those were dominoes, you handed those to a four-year-old kid and you said, hey, why didn't those last four dominoes fall? You wouldn't put together drills for those four remaining dominoes. You'd realize, well, hey, it was probably the domino before that didn't knock it over because the domino before didn't knock
right.
it over.
And so much discussion is based on those like four things you just said. How do I get hip shoulder? How do I get front leg brace?
Yeah, we often spend way too much time focusing on the byproduct, the symptom, rather than the actual cause. And from what I've seen, so much of it starts at the very beginning of the delivery. And if I can't hinge, there's no way I can corkscrew my hips. If I can't hinge, there's no way that I can really get into the ground, plug my feet into the ground. So really, pitching is just about a series of sub-movements. So our first step is always learning how to just move the middle of my body. Because you take hip-shoulder separation, for an example. We're doing all these drills for a guy that has no hip-shoulder separation. Most of those guys that I work with that struggle, they can't stand there in a standstill position and separate their hips from their shoulders. But yet we're asking them to do this in a series of drills while they're moving on one leg, throwing down a mat.
Right, right.
So if I can't do that standing still, there's no way that I could do that any other way. So another way to possibly look at when we think about mechanics, just like long division, if I struggled with addition or subtraction, or if I got the first step in that math problem wrong, there's no way the answer is ever going to be correct. And that's what I see a lot of times with pitching, is that we make it too complicated. Let's focus on just moving a little bit better, becoming a little bit more aware of my body. And suddenly people are patting you on the back saying, man, what drills have you been using? And in reality, it's not. You're just moving more efficiently. You get the beginning right, and then the end just kind of falls in place.
Right. So that allows a pitcher to take, I think the prescription of drills is always challenging, and we always think that we need to do something new and something better, and this is how I'm going to be more efficient, as if I'm not working in enough X amount of plyo throws a certain way or something. Yes. Like that. But a lot of our issues tend to, like you say, stem from the very first domino. If I've already rolled up onto my toe and I'm not grounded, I really don't give myself a chance, you know. So I think, you end up with injuries and inefficiencies, and we're trying so hard to prescribe a medicine when, you know, we probably should have changed our diet initially.
That's exactly right. That's exactly. And most of the pitching problems you see are the problems. It usually reverts back to something very, very small. And then as that small problem continues to move, it just snowballs into bigger problems. But that's what you'll always see. Typically, it's just something very small that started at the very beginning that caused the bigger problems at the end.
Was there one particular pitcher that you saw where you're like, oh man, I love that. This is who I want to try to emulate in who I'm teaching, when I'm teaching guys, you know? Like, did you see somebody and you're like, that's an extremely efficient movement, that's the hinge we need to get guys into? Because I feel like when I watch old video of pitchers, not everybody moved efficiently. It wasn't until this like revolution of everybody is throwing so hard that guys are like really working to squeeze out that last 1 or 2 miles an hour, which may come from a slightly more efficient movement. Was there somebody initially who kind of led you?
That's a great question. You've got made that a two-part. First of all, like my thoughts on why everybody's throwing hard, I don't necessarily, the technology actually helps, but you think about Roger Bannister with he ran under the 4-minute mile, you know, they didn't think it could be done. And right after he did this, you've seen a couple of months follow, suddenly everybody else could do it. So it's more of that belief factor, because they believed it could be done. Now suddenly it raised their potential for getting it done. So you take a group of alpha males in a major league, and this is their livelihood, this is how they feed their family, and they're seeing others that suddenly throw the ball 100, they know that it's possible. So they start to break through the barriers of disbelief, and that's something I see with a lot of athletes. It seems that talent is a low-hanging fruit, but it's the belief that's the star on the Christmas tree that so many people fail to reach. So I think beliefs play a big role in that, because if you want to look at your ultimate potential, ask somebody, how good could you be? I want you to draw a circle representing on this piece of paper, representing your chance to be the best in the world. And if they've got a very small belief circle, that's really ultimately their potential, because how you see yourself is how everybody else is going to see you. And as you start to climb up the ladders, as it gets more difficult, if you don't believe you could do it in the first place, you're just going to find a reason why you can't instead of how you can. So that's one. But as far as looking at other players, I can remember 2012, a buddy of mine, best man at my wedding, he's a scout, and he sends me this video of Lance McCullers, who was a high schooler there. And I'd been watching Bryce Harper, it was just his lower body, and I see Lance, and I'm like, holy crap. So I flipped Bryce around to the other side where they were both right-handed, and it was amazing. And I was like, holy crap, these lower halves, you can't tell who's the hitter, who's the pitcher, except for the slope of the mound. So that was really how I started to look at the lower body and challenged me to look at it differently. But whenever you're starting to evaluate players, I think the mechanical models can become a hindrance, because look, I couldn't write my name the exact same way twice, even though I've done it thousands of times with nobody on base, using only one body part, sitting down. So if I can't sign my own name the same way twice, right, how am I going to sign to Aroldis Chapman's when he can't sign his name the same way? So I think that's a problem for a lot of pitchers. So I think it comes down to, again, purpose. Is what's their purpose? What do they believe they're good at? So if you've got a guy that throws a 12-6 curveball, you think about a 12-6 curveball, it's obviously I'm trying to throw the ball straight up and down. So I'm going to have a higher slot. I'm going to have more stable feet because it requires it. If I have a guy that's he believes his best pitch is a changeup, then he's probably going to be linear. He's not going to have as much rotation. If I have a guy that's a slider, he's probably going to turn the corner a little bit better. So it really comes down to what they're good at, what they believe they're good at, because what they believe they're good at is what they're going to practice. What they practice is what you're going to see most often in the movement patterns. So knowing against –
Would you ever have somebody not try to be more efficient, though? Like, don't you – like, these movements that you teach are still – Even if you're a pushier guy and throw a two-seamer or throw a certain breaking ball a certain way, you still want to be rotating more efficiently, right?
Yes. But as far as the emulation part is saying that here's how I want everybody to look based on this model, it's not possible.
It's not realistic.
Yeah, so you take what they're really good at, because the first thing you want to do in any type of development is weigh the risk versus reward. If I change this guy because I think it would look better, is it going to hurt his stuff? Because you take a guy that might throw a two-seam and a slider, like those guys typically might go slightly across their body because of that. They have, you know, better
for
pitch.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's really taking what they're good. So as far as the emulation, no. But, yeah, you're always training for efficiency, and that's why if you can just – master the basic movements, learning how to hinge, learning how to separate different parts of your body, that's where the efficiency starts to come at. It's just body awareness. I mean, you think about like a skateboarder. The best skateboarders, you can always tell the best skateboarders by watching who falls. You know, like the really good skateboarders, they never get hurt because they know how to fall because of high levels of body awareness. And I almost look at it like it's a marionette puppet. If I handed you, Zach, this marionette puppet, it had thousands of strings, and I said, hey, make this sucker dance, you'd like, no way. Like,
I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah, the first step that you're going to do is probably you're just going to narrow it down to one, and you're going to say, all right, if I move my pinky, this moves his left foot. If I move my index finger, this moves his right hand. So you start to label your strings. Really, that's proprioception. Proprioception is just your mind-body connection.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, to not, because now I'm not no longer overwhelmed if I'm starting at 1 foot. All right, now we lift our leg, as opposed to trying to fix a high-speed movement somewhere down the line.
100%. So you're just going to do it just like a marionette puppet would, and you're just going to take it just one string at a time. And then so once I've got proprioception, knowing what each string is, then I could coordinate the pinky right, the pinky index finger, pinky pointing finger, pinky. So I've got it one at a time. So because without proprioception, which is that knowing where your limbs are, your body parts are, it's kind of like knowing where the keys are on your keyboard on a computer. Until I know where each one of those keys are, I'm going to be slow at pecking away. I'm going to have to stare at the screen the same way with the puppet. The coordination wouldn't exist without knowing, being aware of your body. So our first step, no matter who it is or what it is that we're working on, is building better, higher levels of awareness, because we know with improved awareness comes improved coordination. With improved coordination comes improved synchronization. And now once I can synchronize, I can start to optimize. So that's really our four steps, is build awareness, improve coordination, then start to sync everything together with rhythm and tempo. And then once we've got that pattern, we're actually going to try to break it by creating as much variation and distraction as possible with that.
So when you talk about breaking this pattern, that's to reinforce what you've learned. You're saying to have somebody, like, what would that entail?
Yeah, so let's say for an example, somebody has a tendency to fly open. Okay. We'll take the belt and we'll actually try to pull them open. So it's kind of like with my kids. I remember 1 year, Rex and Reg, they had snow. They're bringing it all over the house. They're tracking the house. So I'm like, all right, guys, I got an idea for you. Why don't you come in and let's have a contest, see who can track the most snow. So as soon as I gave them permission to do so, they no longer did it.
Nobody wants to do it.
So I was working with Neil Ramirez that day, and whenever we tried the same thing, and we just kind of called it reverse psychology at the time, but really it's just another term is just feed the mistake, is we're trying to create distraction, because a big problem I see is the idea that, hey, let's do the same thing. Every pitcher needs a routine. We need to do the same thing every day. But we play a game that rewards adjustment, but we never adjust our training. So our goal is to constantly adjust our training so that we're training to adjust so that when we get onto the game mound, you know, we've been there before.
And I just asked you if there was one guy you emulated this after. Obviously not. Like, you know, that just doesn't make sense to try to look at somebody and be like, that's what I should do. When really you should just be focused on feeling your own efficient movement.
Yeah. And a lot of it too comes to just connecting with the individual, knowing their background. Like, what do you do outside of baseball? Well, I'm a surfer, I'm a skater, I'm a mountain climber, I'm a pianist, whatever it might be. So you can start to speak their language and give them examples of how this same movement or the same thing that we're doing applies in their realm outside of baseball. So it forces them to look at it a little bit differently.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. When a guy is moving efficiently, is there something that you always notice in an individual, or are there certain, like, I know you said, like, you don't do a lot of comparison, like, you obviously compared McCullers and Harper, but you don't do a lot of, like, this guy moves this way, this is what we should strive for. Are there certain cues when you look at an individual that allow you to know he's moving efficiently outside of the product of his swing or how hard the velocity of the pitch was?
Stable feet.
That's your number one.
Stable feet, yeah, because if anytime you see a pitcher with unstable feet, well, you got to think, again, it goes back to rotation. It has to have a fixed point. So if my foot is unstable, there is no fixed point for rotation. So an example of that, if you've ever been to a baseball field and you have to open a fence and you have to lift up on it to open the gate, that would be an example of the feet, because if the gate, the pole that's firmly cemented into the ground, it's going to be able to swing open and without having to lift it up. So that's one way to look at it. But, yes, it comes down to stable feet. Another way is just watching them on the lift. You'll never see a high-level pitcher with unstable feet, because right, rotation couldn't exist without that.
You're just too – it's too, you'll never be able to repeat yourself if you've already left where you're balanced, at your, like, greatest balance point.
No chance. Yeah, because rotation requires a fixed point. If there's no fixed point, there is no rotation. If there is no rotation, there is no efficiency.
See, Lance, you really get going. You go fast, but the premise is very simple. It's keep your foot planted. So it's, you know, it is high level stuff, but it is something that I think people, if they're willing to just take it at the surface level and be like, this is needs to be where my focus is at, you could really make gains very efficiently as opposed to trying to fix 9,000 other things.
Yeah,
which is where I have found myself oftentimes career, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a little cross-fired, so how can I fix this? All right, what if I just push my body that way? No, that didn't really do anything, you know. Like, no, that's very
And
cool.
I think that's why the eyes are so important, too, because wherever – you got to think that our body's built to protect. So the reason there's equal opposite, there's a reason all this stuff's going on, is because we're like a two-legged table. You never probably sat on a two-legged table because you'd fall right over, right? So that's why, like, when I move to the left, my arm goes to the right. It's just trying to keep the balance stable. It's trying to keep it balanced. So a lot of times is if my hips are in the middle, I want to look at the domino in front of it and the domino behind it. That would be the feet and the eyes. It goes back to that hammock. So a lot of times just watching where their eyes go will tell you what their feet can or can't do. So there's always something that affects something else. So it's kind of looking. If I see something at the bottom, I'm going to check the top. If I see something on the right, I'm going to check the left. So it's just an easy way to just kind of the checks and balances system in place to look at some things.
Very cool. When somebody first purchases a belt and they want to get going, it's about exploration, but are there certain drills that you really emphasize people try early on and like get comfortable doing?
Yeah, you know, the first place that we start, and people look at me crazy, is breathing. Like, people underestimate the importance of the breath. One thing that we've seen over and over in our testing is your better breathers are always your better movers. So breathing is a big part of it. The second part is we have five foundational drills. The first one is just hip extension, to where it's basically a seated hinge. The second one is a standing hinge. The third one is starting on two knees and just being able to rotate your hips without your shoulders. Then we stand and do and replicate the process. And then we'll actually just stand in the split stance and try to turn off the middle of our body. So there's five that we really focus on. And these are like daily staples inside our program. It's stuff that we do every single day, because again, if you can't master the basic movements, there's no way to put the basic movements into motion. Like, motion would not be efficient if the basic movements were inefficient.
Right. So all five of those are basically, how can I move my hips and pelvis without moving the rest of my body?
Yes, and you know, the funny thing is, I show people that and they're like, all right, now what do you really do? Right. Because everybody is so conditioned to think that every mechanics are fixed by drills, so they always want to go back to the drill.
That's the most interesting part I find about this whole thing, is that there's always a drill or a prescription, and then getting to know you and learn your program, it's not.
Mm-mm.
That's just not how you go about teaching this, and it's very cool. It's very different.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think that a big thing that we do, and as you've seen in here, is that we'll focus on the movements, and then I think the drill becomes your delivery.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, that's
right.
What we're trying
that's
to
do. That's what
improve.
We're doing. Yeah.
So no, that's really what we're shooting for there.
That makes a lot of sense. So as far as young kids getting on this, is this something that you think if you can teach them younger? Because I know a lot of older guys in professional baseball are trying to make these adjustments now. There's been a lot of discussion about lower half mechanics, you know, for guys who are 25, 28 years old. Do you think these are things that we've gotten wrong up to this point because of certain pitching drills or what we were taught? Or do you think the focus just has been on alternate things and we kind of forgot about our foundation?
Honestly, that's a great question. I think most of the drills that I see are the problems for so many of the mechanical flaws that we see. You take the rocker drill, you take a one knee drills. Like, those are things that really cause a lot of problems. So that's a really good one. I think that as far as the younger kids, honestly, I don't think a kid under 10 or 11 years old even needs a belt. Go out, play other sports. Go climb trees, ride bikes, ride skateboards. And something that's interesting to me over the years is that I've found that my really high-level guys tend to have a background in skating or surfing just because – it requires it,
right? You know, full glute engagement, hams are on the whole time.
Yeah, balance is a strong prerequisite to that. There's the fear of falling, so right. you're more in tune, you're more focused with what you're doing, and they create higher levels of body awareness, which then transfers to the game of baseball. Always look at it this way: like if you look at movement as the keyboard. If I don't know my keyboard and I have to peck away, then I'm going to be very slow. I'm not going to be very efficient at it, no matter if it's Facebook, if it's Twitter, if it's whatever. But let's just think that Facebook requires a certain set of emojis or letters, and then you go to TikTok and it requires this, and you go to Twitter and it requires this. By seeing Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, using no matter what's on the screen, the keyboard's going to be the same. So the more efficient that I get on using like different sports, the more higher levels of body awareness. So that's going to apply to whether it's basketball, to whether it's baseball, to whether it's right. football. It's still all the same thing right. because your best athletes are the guys that have the highest levels of body awareness. And because they have higher levels of body awareness, they're seen as more athletic. The guys that are unathletic or your poor movers are the guys that just have less awareness of their right. body.
Well, fortunately for Core Velocity Belt, kids are specializing in one sport very, very early and are going to need the help. So, you know, there is not a lot of emphasis put on how do I move as a whole. That was something that's come up in a few of my other discussions is I always trained for the sake of training because I thought it would help my baseball. I was never that focused on like how should my movement patterns in my exercises directly correlate to what I'm doing on a mound. And so I'd find myself like, you know, thinking I was weight room strong, but I had no idea how to apply that force into the rubber,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I find myself rolling onto a toe, pushing across. And it's only now at this age that I'm trying to like make these big adjustments. And the simplicity with which you teach it is just so interesting to me because I never even thought to get to that point in my personal journey on my own. Like I'd think I needed 9,000 things to change when really like my first step was wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting. And you see, it's very cool that you see that with other major leaguers, like guys like Lucas Giolito who have worked with you. McCullers is so cleaned up now. You know, these guys, maybe they did it in the past, but needed to get back to it. And you found a way to very simply get them utilizing their whole frame again.
Yeah, what it comes down to, and it's this kind of this grinding mentality you see on Twitter. Hey, I went out and I threw for 45 minutes. Like, that's just not how the brain views information. It's not how you make changes. It comes down to the quality versus the quantity. So I always tell guys all the time, I'd much rather see 5 quality reps than 500 inefficient reps, because at the end of the day, what you see, the results you see on the mound are a direct reflection of what you're doing off the mound. It's just like taking a test. Whatever I've prepared for, how studious, the quality of the time that I've spent studying this is how well I'm going to do on the test. But most of the time in pitching, we don't look at it this way. We have a bad outing, and all of a sudden we blame it on mechanics. We go see another pitching coach, and then we're doing 15 different things, and we just keep, you know, it's kind of like asking a guy to go find the go sit in the corner of a circular room, and you wonder why he's pacing around and he's halfway nuts. It's because that's kind of what I've been guilty of in the past, and it's kind of where we've moved towards, is just keeping it simple and realizing that really at the end of the day, making every rep count. It's all about the quality, and that's once you've got the quality of information that you're sending to the brain by making every rep count, having a focus, getting the feedback, that's really where change starts to happen, and it happens the quickest.
Right. Very cool. So Core Velocity Belt moving forward, I know you still do speak with Pitchapalooza. Going forward, is there a revamped version of the Core Velocity Belt in the future? Do you think we have a very good stable spot right here? Where do you kind of see the Core Velocity Belt evolving?
Well, we're always trying new stuff.
I know you're a big testing guy.
Yeah,
you always got something
new
testing.
It's always something new. And honestly, I think our next big move is going to be into other sports like the golf market, because the more we test it in golf, it's been great. Because, again, any rotational sport, it's going to apply. The kinetic chain is a kinetic chain. And in any sport, it just comes down to moving more efficiently through the middle. The more efficient that I move, the cleaner the mechanics, the higher the exit speed or the arm speed. So it's all the same throughout, no matter which sport. So we're probably going to be, or we will be making a move towards the golf.
Very cool,
will be our
yeah.
next step.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. It's just interesting to me. I know I keep coming back to this. It's not that complex of a premise, But it's what you've built allows people to find it so efficiently, and there just hasn't really been another way that people have found it other than discussion, you know, or trying to give somebody a cue, which is what has, I find the most interesting about this whole thing.
And, you know, the most overlooked aspect of the belt is, again, first it's the drills and the movements, but a lot of times it's just by wearing it, because how it works, and I'm going to go back to the premise the body's always trying to protect itself, is that the brain's on high alert. Think of the brain like an overprotective parent. Until you've shown to me that you can actually drive, I'm not going to let you take the car to the mall, right? So by how it's designed, or where it squeezes around the glutes and the entire belt, there's no hold where it goes around the waist and the legs like a harness, it actually squeezes the entire glutes in the pelvic region, and by doing so it gets the brain's attention. It's kind of like if you've had an ankle brace, or you've had braces on your teeth, you take it off and you're like, you feel like it's still there, because it squeezes that pressures that middle of your body. The brain doesn't know whether it's a core velocity belt or a boa constrictor, so it sets off some alarms. So whenever you take it off, that's why you feel lighter and faster. Because it's increasing proprioception, because it's got the brain's attention, and you take it off, and so you still feel the same way. So that's one way I'm constantly stressing to people, is like, just when you're throwing, even without the cords attached, just wearing, right, especially within the first 2 weeks.
Well, that's very cool. Well, Lance, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been awesome insight. It's been very cool for me to discuss with you. I've gotten to know you pretty well, and I always enjoy our discussions. I end up getting quiet because you end up giving me so much information. I love it. But thank you so much for taking the time. I think it's very cool what you've been able to do and transition from, you know, a device that you guys were sewing yourself into something that's become a staple in major league clubhouses is pretty awesome.
I appreciate it, Zach. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
All right.